Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Simon Payne. Simon Payne studied time-based media at the Kent Institute of Art and Design, Maidstone and electronic imaging at Duncan of Jordanstone, Dundee. He then received a PhD from the Royal College of Art in 2008. His work has been shown in numerous festivals, and he is the editor of Sequence magazine. Good afternoon, Simon. Thank you very much for coming in.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
That's okay. So what should we... perhaps we could have a bit of background, first of all. If you could tell me, when you went to college, what did you... You were studying art originally, or how did you get into time-based media, if that's the correct...
Well, first of all, I did a foundation course at Winchester School of Art. And on the foundation course there, we did, various different things, as you do, I suppose, on foundation. And partly, part of what we did was to make films and videos in what was called time-based media there.
Oh, right.
And the tutor who took us for that was George Saxon. Do you know
him?
Oh,
yes, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Who I thought was a wonderful filmmaker.
Right.
And
so at this time, were you actually trying to... What was your inroad into art? Were you trying to be a painter, or did you not... were you just prepared to sort of do anything at this stage?
I think I did... before that, I was just, doing kind of... It was just at school, and you think do this and that, and I guess by default you happen to be in... happen to be painting things, but...
So it but it was art rather than cinema, shall we say?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I teach in a film studies course now, a BA film studies course, and it's actually really only since teaching that I've had to kind of really gen up on cinema.
Oh right.
I mean,
it
wasn't really ever an interest to me while I was at art school, making films in that context. I never really looked at cinema proper, but from a very early period in that kind of educational context, I was drawn towards experimental film very quickly.
Right, okay.
And video art.
Yeah. Roughly when was this? What sort of period were we talking
about? Let me see now. 1995, I think.
Right.
I think 94, I think I started.
Yeah.
I did my foundation course.
Right.
And in Winchester, when I was there, which was just for a year or less, really, 9 months, I suppose, the library had on VHS stuff like The Ghosts in the Machine broadcasts that were on Channel 4 or Midnight Underground.
Right.
So I don't know how, but I just happened across those compilations. Stuff that was broadcast on Channel 4, I don't know when that would have been, perhaps early 90s.
Yeah.
But in any case, it was on VHS tape, and I could watch all this stuff in the library there.
Yeah.
And also, various things. David Larcher's Granny's Is, is one of the first things I saw there.
Right. So did these have a kind of marked impression on you? Did they sort of make you want to just head in that direction?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I hadn't come across anything like that before. And, I don't know why I picked up a video camera or got interested in making films, but it just seemed to me there was a confluence anyway.
And was it video then?
It was video, yeah.
All right. Has it ever been film at all?
Not really. One 60mm film project in the second year when I was at Maidstone, which in fact was even a group project, so I, had no...
Yeah.
it wasn't my authorial control there.
So you never chose film as such then?
And numerous people said I ought to.
At the time?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, tutors.
Okay. But you refused.
I kind of refused. I don't know why that was. Slightly... I don't know. Not really a logic behind it.
So you were drawn towards electronic media rather than what we might call, chemical media, I suppose.
I think I just... There's something very immediate about looking, through the video camera and knowing pretty much what it was that you were going to what you're recording in a way, the kind of nature of the pictures that you're making.
So it's the instant feedback, perhaps, or you know, perhaps feedback is the wrong word, but at least you can see exactly what you're filming at the time.
I mean, I did at college, do numerous kind of experiments with feedback and kind of video installations, which might involve the box and pointing the camera in a certain way and seeing what would happen with that kind of setup. But I guess in the single screen film, the single screen pieces which I've made, largely, that's what I've kind of focused on rather than kind of installation or, in a way, video proper. I guess I always tended to look to film and something about how filmmakers structured time. I don't know why that was really, but certainly it was much easier in a way to edit video. I mean, I can't imagine how people go through the process of editing film and having to send stuff to, neg cutters and, working with... film labs and what have you. That was kind of anathema to me in a way.
So your present films or the films over the last 10 years or so, I suppose, are all completely abstract. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's no.
At that time, did you ever do representational kind of work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of videos which are to do with pointing cameras at kind of overlooked. Places in the house or surfaces and textures and seeing what what one could do with
So this was Maidstone or was it still at Winchester?
At Winchester,
because I was thinking at Maidstone there was of course it's Nicky Hamlin,
and I was very
one of the teachers.
I was very influenced by Nicky's films while I was there, and in a way subsequently I'm a big fan. Steve Lippman was also a tutor at Maidstone, and I had a lot of time for his work. Do you know him?
No.
His work at all? Steve was, I think, like a great example of a kind of video artist proper, in a way. We had two massive, well, they very complicated, even if they weren't massive, but complicated kind of video editing stations, which were three machine edit suites, they were called, which allowed you to do things like dissolve between one videotape and another.
Yes.
And had a rather big mixing desk, you know, comparable to something what we've got in front of us here.
And at that time, it was tape, of course.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there were all these different formats, weren't there? Kind of, what is it?
That was like Hi8.
Hi8, okay.
Hi8, but you were going to Beta SP, which was a pretty much broadcast standard.
Right,
But Steve would make work which involved kind of pulling all the plugs out of both edit suites, which must have been a nightmare for the technicians there, and repatching together two three-machine edit suites so that you could have effectively six machines, I guess, running at the one time. And, you know, I'm not sure that people work like that at all now, you know, because everything is kind of, on one's computer and... You know, one, perhaps two screens, but certainly no machines.
Right.
And mixing is done rather, in a kind of abstract fashion.
Yes.
On the timeline of Final Cut Pro or whatever.
Right.
But also, I just had one more point about Steve.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think his work is, in a way, is wonderful and is not seen enough. Mm. When everything kind of switched from three machine editing to digital. Editing, like Premiere or whatever. Mm. I think it was Premiere. He'd never be happy unless the computer was crashing when it was trying to render the work, you know, and he'd always have as many layers as possible.
What did that look like then, if you had various layers? What do you mean? Not superimposition?
Yeah, superimpositions.
Okay.
I mean, with three-machine type editing, you could have two layers, and you could add more, but of course the picture kind of deteriorated before your eyes. Mm. So the big thing, I think... for video artists, in a way, about moving into digital territory was that you could have superimpose numerous layers without the degradation of the image. Mm. But I kind of had a soft spot, or still do, for that generation of video artists, I think, who really pushed the technology as far as it could go in a kind of...
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. So it was,
but I didn't ever go there.
You didn't go into that realm, you mean?
Not really.
Activity of... No. Okay. But you did actually... So you've never used film as such?
No.
Apart from this one exercise that you were forced to do. Mm-hmm. And then... So I'm just quite interested because it's sort of opposed to the way that I got into film, right, as it were. I mean, I was always only ever interested in film. I was always averse to video, mm-hmm, in some strange way, although I did remember wanting to hire a Porter pack when they first came out, so which gives you an idea of, sort of reveals one's age somewhat. But the Sony Porter pack, which like Nam June Paik used, I think. But so when did you first get into... But tell me, so after that, you kind of... where did you go from there? Maidstone and then Dundee?
That's right.
And what was the connection with Dundee? How did you get to...
The connection with Dundee was... I really wanted to do kind of an additional... I wanted to stay in the environment of education. You know, I wanted more to continue, working in a way. And I think that was quite difficult, actually, when I left Maidstone. I managed to get a little bit of time in an edit suite in a kind of open access place in Southampton where I was living. But actually, the means of production, the resources were, I didn't have in my grasp. So it was, one good reason for going on and continuing in higher education was that there'd be another year or so, making stuff.
Right.
And the connection with Dundee was, I think, that a lot of people seem to go for one reason or another. Well, I know where they went to Dundee is because they had it was a very well-resourced course, the School of Television and Imaging there, run by Stephen Partridge.
Right, okay.
Who's a wonderful video artist and who had connections that went back to Maidstone by some years. And so one occasion Steve was driving up to Maidstone, Steve Lippmann, to give a talk about his work. He said, why don't you come have a look at the course? Mm. And we drove up there non-stop, almost. Mm-hmm.
So then you get to you did a PhD at the Royal College later. And at what point had you committed to sort of digital computer generated films at this by this time?
I think in the context, the PhD thing took a long time, and it was only ever I was doing it part time. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it maybe took a long time, and it was not something that I wanted to see as consuming all my time. So the work I made was influenced, of course, by being there, and the kind of the issues that I was trying to get to grips with, I suppose, in writing about things in the context of the PhD. And maybe it was during that period, from between 2001 and 2006 or 7, that I made a transition to be making work which was kind of purely generated within the computer.
Right.
Putting aside the video camera and making, because for me the video work that I'd been making kind of reiterated in a way questions to do with representation and the idea that the viewer be watching the work and wondering what is that I'm looking at. I know it's a kind of camera recorded image, but I don't know quite what it is. And I think that came from having been influenced by numerous filmmakers, including Nicky, but others as well.
Such as?
Well, like Peter Goodall, for example.
Right.
Or maybe Malcolm LeGrice, even.
Yeah. Is that because they, because of Peter Goodall's theory of materialist film, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think...
Or was he actually... He wasn't a teacher at that time.
No, I only met him...
So it was only through his writing,
yeah,
or the films, or both?
Well, the writing, and I did make journeys to go to the Lux, or it was the London Filmmakers Co-op then, and to watch some of Peter's films.
Right.
Admittedly, on the film checking machine.
Oh yeah.
I hadn't seen them at all projected, but I'd read about them a lot.
Mm.
So watch them on this tiny machine.
Yeah, oh, did you? So you sorted them out. You sort of said, I want to go and see those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And is that because the theory appealed to you in some way?
You
attracted to this?
Well, the books stood out somehow or other. I think, I don't know how you get to pick up certain books in libraries, you know, no. or in Winchester, how it is that certain VHS tapes popped out of the shelves. One book that popped out of the shelf for me at Winchester when I was there on foundation was Malcolm McGrice's Abstract Film and Beyond.
Right, yeah, I was going to mention that later.
And then,
With Peter Goodall, the kind of, isn't the part of the attraction is this sort of certainty, isn't there? He expresses his opinions with seeming absolute confidence.
Yeah.
As though, and there is an attraction about that.
Also the fact that they're kind of contradictory and you can't always make out exactly what he's getting at, but you know the tenor of it, in a way.
But said with certainty.
Said with certainty, absolute conviction. I think there are many contradictions, in a way. And part of that, I think, was the appeal for me, you know, when I first got hold of Materialist Film, which is a book from 1989.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things that I sought a copy of and then have had to keep going back to.
Right, right.
So in a way, I think also, you know, starting to make these digital works with colour, pure colour and hardly any shape, but these kind of almost purist digital colour abstract videos was in a way trying slightly to put behind some of the issues that were raised perhaps in kind of materialist film theory to do with representation.
And was there a point when you decided to sort of abandon the camera as such? I mean, I presume your films are generated within the computer.
Yeah.
Without the use of a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I made this... I made a video at Alexandra Palace, which I don't think I'd really show anymore at all, because it's quite a mishmash of things. But I gained access to Alexandra Palace and the old TV studios from where television was first broadcast. And there are various kind of bits and bobs in the studio, the old cameras, and it's quite a kind of evocative environment. And the piece I made in there was kind of observational in a way. But I ended it with colour bars.
Right.
Which is the test signal that comes at the front of video programs that go out for broadcast and what have you.
Yeah, so these are vertical bars.
Vertical stripes sort of colour.
How many are there, roughly? Or does it vary?
There's white, yellow, cyan, green, magenta, red, blue, and black.
Right.
And so there's this little animated sequence anyway at the end of this film, in which I kind of orchestrated these colour bars, which are normally a static signal, static picture.
Yes.
Used for reference, for engineers and what have you. I animated them to move them across the screen, so they're animated colour bars.
Yeah. So you had a representational film made in Alexandra Palace?
Yeah, in the TV studio there.
How long was the film, roughly?
Maybe 10 or 15 minutes.
And what does it show, the interior of Alexandra Palace?
It shows the interior of the studio.
Yeah, and then it had this colour bar, which would normally be edited out, I presume. It would be something that wouldn't normally be seen because you'd just use it for... as you say, for like, I don't know, for checking colours, balance and so on.
That's right. For good, you know, good practice, video makers, I guess in all contexts. This was something that was kind of drummed into us at Maidstone, for example, is that you put colour bars and tone at the beginning of your tape for a minute or, you know, however long.
Yeah.
So that if ever you were to have your work broadcast or if it was sent to a festival or whatever, they can, you know, set up their equipment or set up, so that the colours are correct.
Yes. And so you decided to include the colour bar
at the end
as
of
part
this
of
piece.
Your film and actually start to do to play around with it in some way.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me using the expression play around. And perhaps it was a more serious intent. But,
no, that was it.
Okay. Right. So now you've got to the stage where you're working on the colour bar.
Yeah.
And you must have then, you made a decision, perhaps, what happened next? By the next film, you decided to opt out of not use the camera anymore and dump the representational stuff as well. Or was it not as simple as that.
Well, I think it's not as premeditated or necessarily thought through as that. I mean, just followed my nose a little bit.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how, but Peter Goodall did see that film that was shot in Alexandra Palace, and I remember him making the comment that he was interested in that bit at the end.
Right, OK, that's interesting.
So, I think I mulled it over, you know, for quite a while, and was just thinking, is it possible maybe to make a piece just using the colour bars?
Right.
Would it be too reductive? Would it be interesting? And then just, you know, from kind of like seeing...
What did you do with the colour bars exactly? Is it possible to describe what you, what happened with them?
Well, what I did was, I had these, so the colour bars that are set up in this particular order, and then I made them traverse the screen from left to right in a repeated fashion. So they keep
they keep coming round.
That's
so the
right.
black bar would appear again on the left-hand side
That's
of the screen
right.
and
yeah.
move to the right.
That's
so
right.
they just keep going round.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I had this recorded onto a tape, you know, a long passage of it. And then...
And was this done in a computer?
Yeah, that was done in a computer.
Right. Okay.
And then... So I had that on a tape, and then I... What did I do next? Oh, I know what I did. Yes, re-imported that into the computer, this kind of these rolling bars.
Yeah.
And then set the and then I kind of, this is really a fudge, I think. The work was made quite quickly and easily. It looks like it's more complicated. But I set the camera to record, again, the output from the computer, which... So now I had these colour bars laid out on the timeline, of this digital video editing software, right?
Yeah.
But instead of playing out this series again as a smooth rolling bars, I kind of flitted around on the timeline, using the cursor, going from one position to another.
Right.
So it picked out different moments.
I think James knows more about what you're talking about than I do, actually.
In any case...
James, the engineer, is present. You've lost me, but anyway...
This is a difficulty about talking about things, isn't it? Having an adequate language.
No, it's all right. Go on.
But anyway, it would generate a kind of randomised sequence of these colour bars in different positions and different arrangements on the screen. So that what they're
when you say randomised, you mean you weren't making the decision?
Well, I was insofar as I was. It was kind of a cross between rather improvisatory, I suppose, in a way.
Right.
Dotting around the timeline very quickly with a cursor and sending out to the tape individual frames, if you like, from the timeline of these rolling colour bars.
Okay.
And so what it results in when you play the tape back is kind of like these very flickering...
Yes.
Flickering arrangements of colour bars.
Can we play one of your... Shall we play one of your films? Because
this
sort of taps into what's the name of this film? It's a suite of films on a DVD, isn't it? What do we call it?
Well, I call them colour field videos.
Colour field videos.
Yeah.
Okay.
The people at home listening will be wondering what they're going to see.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah.
Not anything.
So there's five films on here dating from 2004 and going on to 2011. And the first one is called Colour Bars.
Yeah.
And I did look at it yesterday. And as far as I could make out, my personal sort of... Okay, so it starts out looking like a colour bar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
With vertical...
At the moment we're playing back... I've got my laptop here and it's set up. I just put the disc in.
Yes.
And in a sec it'll appear...
Right.
...on the laptop.
And this one has a soundtrack or not?
No.
This is silent. Okay, so for the listeners at home, we're watching a silent film now. Based on colour bars, so if you sort of imagine, I suppose most people will have seen colour bars, won't they? Do you think
I don't know if they will.
OK. Well, it's electronically produced vertical bars of colour. We've got the credits coming up at the moment. Very flickered through. OK. And these are already... There's quite rapid movement, rapid change of colour from these bars, which fluctuate. They're various different thicknesses. Widths, shall we say?
Yeah.
Widths. And it goes through the whole spectrum. And when I looked at it, there seemed to be no discernible, consistent system that I could gather. I mean, I couldn't see any particular repetition or... to me, it looks like it's randomly generated, as though it's almost as though... I mean, I'm guessing that you've somehow set up the computer to sort of carry out a system of permutations, or have you actually chosen each and every stripe?
Well, I didn't choose it. No. It's kind of the generation of these frames is kind of improvised, as I said.
Yeah.
Which left me with a bunch of random flickery frames on a tape.
Yeah.
And I think it's not necessarily evident in the piece, but it's kind of, there is a kind of a structure to it which underlied, you know, part of the rationale for putting it together.
But is it a human design structure, or is it one that taps into the pre-existing structure that the computer is sort of supplying you with? You see what I mean? That it's going through permutations that you ask the computer to do for you. Am I completely on the wrong track?
It's not... No, there's nothing about it. I don't think in any of the work that I've made, none of it's like produced by a kind of program which I've designed to output certain kind of permutations or what have you.
Right. Okay. So you would have chosen... How would you choose the what we're watching? How would you have chosen or made the decision that arrived at what we're seeing?
I think it goes back to this question of having these rolling colour bars on a timeline.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then pressing record on a tape, on a video recorder.
Yeah.
Which is receiving the output from my computer.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And then instead of playing out that sequence.
So you're sort of almost playing it like an instrument, aren't you? It's almost like a colour organ,
yeah.
I suppose.
Well, in a way,
a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I hadn't really thought of that association before, but certainly, yeah, it's playing it, a kind of improvised playing of this sequence,
right,
on the timeline.
But it is entirely computer generated. You've now lost representation. You've done away with the camera.
Yeah.
You're doing it entirely within the computer.
Yeah.
And it is a sort of... there is a sort of genre of this, isn't there? What you call colour field video, or... Do you even call it video?
I think so, yeah. I do. Mainly because...
It's just I have a friend who makes computer-generated works.
Mm-hmm.
And I never know what to call him. If I say he's a video artist, he's not a filmmaker, he's not a video artist.
Mm.
It's not really computer art as such. There is an association with video.
Yeah.
Is it accurate to call it video?
I don't know. I think video is such a kind of slippery... It's a difficult one to pin down in a way. And, you know, having been with video technology through, you know, places like Winchester, Maidstone and Dundee, you know, every year, the technology changed.
Right.
And also, in a sense, the characteristics of the medium.
Yeah, yeah. So it started out as tape, of course. You started with videotape, but then this is, as you say, time has gone by, and it's. So let's. Can we have a? Perhaps we should play one with a bit of a sound to it. Could we? Can we move on to the next one, which is? Let me see. The next one is called New Ratio, which is 1:45 stereo, and this one looked to me sort of viewing it last night for the first time, like it looked almost like an exhaustive catalogue of aspect ratios, which to people, aspect ratios is basically the size of the rectangle we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
What was it for? I suppose classic cinema was 4:3 or something.
Yeah.
4:3. Then you had CinemaScope and all these various cinematic formats, actually.
Yeah.
And is that what they are? Is it like a catalogue of those squares, those shapes?
It only shifts between the pieces made up of squares or rectangles.
Can we play this one? Or what's happened to it?
Nothing.
New ratio.
Do you want to talk over the top?
Oh, yeah, because we could hear some sounds from the new ratio film.
Okay.
Yeah, let's listen to it, because this one has got some sound attached, hasn't it? So with this, they look to me like, as you say, it's called aspect ratios. Are they the varying? Are these rectangles? Do they correspond with cinematic formats?
I made this. There are two kind of ratios, if you like, here: 4:3 and 16:9. And part of the rationale for making it was I was just thinking about what's happening in video. Now that we're moving to 16:9 as being a kind of the standard ratio,
right,
which I think is in a way far poorer than 4:3. But in any case, it was about I just wanted to get to make a piece which somehow or other addressed this movement between 4:3 and 16:9. So the coloured squares that comprise the piece, or rectangles, are either 4:3 in their ratio, or 16:9, and there's the sequence of colours again, and the colours go back to the standard palette that I used in colour bars, and all the pieces, or nearly all the pieces that I've made since colour bars, use this palette,
right,
of white, yellow.
Yeah, yeah. Shall we play the next one so we can continue with it? We can have a continuing soundtrack underneath. This one's called Iris Out. And in fact, this one is probably the only one that could be said to have a metaphorical, or it relates to something in the do you know what I mean, in terms of it they could be seen as eyes. It's called Iris Out. It looks like for a start, we've got a circle instead of rectangles and verticals and horizontals. And the inner circle expands and contracts. And it looks like an eyeball, basically, doesn't it? Or an iris. Is that the idea, that it relates to the eye? Is it the camera's iris, which you don't use?
Well, I hadn't thought about the camera's iris, but again, it kind of like thinking about ratios, the screen ratios again. I imagine, because it's very easy to project or show the film in the wrong ratio.
Right.
You know, you see this sometimes in festivals or whatever, in any context.
Yeah.
Especially when people are getting used to this transition from between 4:3 and 16:9, that stuff gets projected in the wrong way.
Right. And then it crops off part of the image.
Well, either crops it off, or it squeezes it in one way or another.
Right.
And stretches.
Yeah.
And so with this piece, I thought what I would do is, again, make... it would involve these sequences which are either 4:3 or 16:9, and I would squeeze or stretch them myself. So sometimes the circles you see are circular, and sometimes they're ellipses, which come from...
Oh, so you've created the ellipse.
Yeah.
That's not a... And where does the circle come from?
Well, the circle is...
Is that a computer-generated shape?
The circle is an iris in film language terms, film grammar, if you like, is a transition, right? An iris in or an iris out takes us from one scene to another. Something, a transition you might associate with early film.
I was going to say, yes, that's a very old, from the birth of cinema.
One way of taking us from one place to another. And so it's a transition that one can use in Final Cut Pro or any other editing software, rather like a wipe or a dissolve.
Right.
And here I thought, instead of using the iris out, which is not, I'll use it as an image in its own right, rather than a transition from one thing to another.
Okay.
And so that was interesting to me, to use it as an image in its own right.
But did you, in order to get to these shapes, did you have to actually draw or create anything within the computer? No. They exist already in the software or something.
That's right.
Right. I suppose this is what I'm getting at. It seems to me that whatever you do, it's as though you're sort of denying any kind of... You're trying to deny the human intervention almost. It's like you're determined to start with things that already exist in the machine. Is that fair?
I suppose so, yeah. They're impersonal works, in a sense. There's no touch, you know, there's no touch of... My touch is not evident.
No, nobody's touch. It's not intended as a criticism, but I'm just kind of...
There's no indexical trace.
It's like an ultimate sort of purity, in a way. It's like saying, you know, because, I mean, obviously it relates to... It looks like sort of abstract films that one might have seen, or abstract paintings, you know, hard-edge painters, I don't know, Kenneth Noland or Barnett Newman or any of these people, or Oscar Fischinger films, Len Lai colour box or whatever. But in all of those cases, the shapes and colours have sort of been chosen and created by the artist. In your case, it's like you're sort of trying to deny that choosing... Well, you're still choosing, but you're choosing something that has already been chosen. It's a pre-chosen thing.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, I have increasingly looked back to abstract filmmakers like Fischinger, for example. Not all of his films, but certain ones of them. And Hans Richter, for example.
Oh, yeah.
But in Hans Richter's film Rhythm 21, made in 1921, it's essentially squares... or rectangles being squeezed or expanding, contracting.
Right.
And Richter talks about that film as not being as being about squeezing the frame, squeezing the in.
Right.
So for him in that film, and also in sequences of, say, Walter Ruttmann's early abstract films, you see kind of... traces and attempts of filmmakers to articulate the kind of edges of the screen or the confines of the medium somehow or other.
Right.
I think that's a big contrast with Fischinger, whose imagery is much more kind of organic in a way.
Right. But your films are definitely not organic.
No, they're kind of... I think you're right to say they're kind of hard-edged and rather...
Yeah. So is it an attempt at a sort of pure cinema in a way, a pure film where there's a purity of abstraction or something?
I think it just comes from working with what I've got, in a way.
Right.
What I am quite... what I have been thinking about, in a way, is how the work is really generated by me sitting in front of the computer.
Mm.
You know, it's fairly solitary kind of activity.
Right.
When I could be out with a camera pointing at the world.
Yes.
But, you know, at the same time, what I think is quite important, you know, is that the work has a kind of an effect on the space in which it's shown. I mean, that's kind of key for me, and that's... You know, it's got nothing to do with, in a way, pointing the camera at the real world, but when these pieces are screened in a cinematic context, they illuminate the room, and they have a very physical kind of effect on the audience, on the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, in a sense, the arena or the territory in which I see the work having a relationship with the world,
So it's the effect of the image on the screen on it, but it's sort of eliminated everything behind that. I mean, in cinema, there's a whole production process which gets you to that screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the camera, the world, the camera, you know, the technicians, the whole thing. You've literally, what should we call it, excised all of that. And now we're left with the machine in the room.
Yeah, but also I think it's not completely insular. I think in the sense that it refers to a kind of a tradition, like I've in a sense, argued the tradition of abstract film.
But there is obviously a tradition of abstract painting, you know, like an op art, kinetic art. It reminds me of, you know, of various people. Someone like Peter Sedgley did a thing with circles. But I suppose the thing with painting is it does not. The apparatus was never designed for representation in the way that cameras were.
Well,
so
I don't know about that. I
mean, well, cameras are obviously designed originally, but you've done away with the camera, so mm-hmm. perhaps this is a non-starter. We're into some other realm. Perhaps we should move on from this. Right. So the next one, the last one, is actually described as a sort of reworking of Iris, the Iris film, and it says, makes some reference to MLG, who we think is Malcolm LeGrice.
Yeah.
Which is the last film of this group.
I'll put that on, just because it helps me to focus,
okay.
even if no one
yes,
else
indeed.
Can see it.
Yeah. Iris out cubed, so this is in effect three images side by side.
Yeah,
I think we were looking at Iris out, and now this one is called Iris out cubed or Iris out times three.
Yeah,
and then is it for MLG or after MLG?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like an in reference. I was putting the stuff together for this DVD because. Myself and a colleague, Neil Henderson, we've started in a way a small DVD label. There's three of them now. The fourth to come soon. One has got Samantha Rebello's work on it. The other is Neil Henderson's work, and this, and also my work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking about putting something else additional on the disc here, and also. And not just an opportunity for me to think about the possibility that this piece, Iris Out, might have another life as a three-screen work.
Right.
Which I think I'll have the opportunity to try out soon.
Well, that brings up the question. I mean, for me, they work incredibly well on a computer. I mean,
yeah.
they are almost ideal films to look at. Mm-hmm. On a computer.
Mm.
Do you project them?
Yeah, they're nearly all. I mean, all my work is largely projected.
Right.
At the same time, I think, you know, it's part of the medium that that one's able to show them on screens of all sorts of sizes.
Yeah.
And what have you.
Mm. How many frames a second?
25.
Is that right? Yeah.
I mean,
is it not, with digital technology, can you increase that?
I guess you could work at any kind of frame rate.
I mean, could you have 100 frames a second? Or would that not?
I think it all depends on what you're running, how fast your computer's running.
I see.
But video, you know, the kind of what we watch on television,
yeah, yeah.
and what we kind of understand as video art and what, you know, mm. DVDs, etc.
Yeah.
You know, if they're PAL DVDs, PAL video is 25 frames a mm. second, and so that's been a kind of like a meter.
Yeah,
a rhythm for me.
And I presume there's a point at which it is no longer discernible that if you start to make a difference of a hundredth of a frame, a hundredth of a second, it's perhaps the human eye doesn't pick it up anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, 25 frames a second.
It's like the minimum sort of requirement
yeah.
in order for you to catch some what you're seeing.
That's right.
So because in a lot of in some of these earlier ones, there is that. Almost moire sort of effect, for want of a better word. You know what I mean? Where it's almost even when it's a white screen or a yellow screen, you've got this kind of miasmic
mm-hmm.
Patterns are almost created. How are you creating that? Is that because in the Flicker film by Tony Conrad or mm-hmm. Arnulf Rayner, the mm-hmm. Kubelka film, it's done by black and white squares, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or alternate black and white frames,
mm-hmm.
which then creates a kind of colour, actually,
yeah.
an illusion of colour.
Mm.
I mean, are you doing any of that to create those effects?
Well, I think part of it is, it's when you're watching the work, I think you can see what it's made up of, a fairly restricted palette and a fairly restricted kind of range of forms, squares, rectangles or circles in these works. And you can pretty much read, I think, often the kind of structural, the development of the work.
Right.
But what I'm quite keen on is all those effects that happen which you can't necessarily account for.
No,
and
right,
I can't account for them any better than...
Oh, well, that's interesting. I'm glad you said that. I see. Okay, so something comes out of it which you hadn't predicted.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, most of... in a way, none of it's predicted, I think one's struggled to kind of account for the effects that they do generate.
Yeah.
The business about frame rates, I suppose. Film... 24 frames a second, video 25 frames a second. That's the kind of frame rate, including the shutter in between for film, at which the illusion of smooth movement is reproduced.
Yeah.
You know, for horses galloping across the prairie or whatever.
Yeah.
Or for cars going down the road. So that's why, you know, and it's anything below that, smooth movements tends to kind of be disrupted, you know, and you see see them as individual frames. You see the spaces in between.
Yeah. Where do you see this going next, or do you not? Because you've created a fair body of work now, which fits into this sort of what you might call the colour field genre, and you've curated shows about colour field video works or digital. I mean, do you foresee what you might do next, or will you continue with this area of filmmaking?
I think the next two pieces that I want to make do involve a camera again.
Oh, right.
And I'm quite keen. I mean, there's two in a way. I'm quite keen. I went to an art shop recently and bought a bunch of coloured card.
In the
same palette.
Yeah.
Roughly. And I thought it'd be rather interesting to do something with, you know, reflecting natural light off coloured card. That'll be a starting point for a piece.
Okay. So this involves stuff in the real world.
Yeah.
No, if you excuse the expression, the real world, but you know what I mean. Mm. It's not from within the machine.
Mm. Mm.
You've bought card and a camera.
Mm-hmm. I've got a camera here.
Okay.
I do have a camera.
You've
I do
always
use
had
it.
A camera. Right. Okay.
But I just don't use it for my work at the moment.
All right.
I mean, I do kind of.
And you think is that because you've sort of do you think that with this work you've maybe gone as far with it as you actually want to go, or it's as far?
Well, the other thing I'm doing immediately, like next week, is travelling to Canada to Windsor, Ontario.
Mm.
There's a very good film festival in Windsor, Ontario called Media City, who've shown my work in the past on a few occasions, and generally they're kind of cinema screening events. The work is projected, but they also each year take over the gallery, or at least two of the gallery spaces at the Art Gallery of Windsor, Ontario, and they've asked me on this occasion, with Nikki Hamlin and a painter named Angela Allen, to install some work in the gallery context there. So for that, I'm making a piece that involves three projectors projecting colour fields, red, green and blue, but very slow, actually. They slowly wipe across the screen, so the antithesis of this flickery, flickery stuff. And what I'm quite keen to do there is to arrange the projectors in the gallery at a kind of obtuse angles to the wall, so that the spectrum of red, green, or blue is spread across the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Work with those conditions in a way. Colour in a three-dimensional gallery.
So are all the walls projected onto? Three of the walls.
There'll be, I think there'll be four. There's four walls to the space, but I'm going to use two of them.
Mm.
And projecting from kind of obtuse angles will make these kind of trapezoid shapes.
Right.
So I'm quite keen also about how the light of the projector onto one wall would bounce onto the other walls.
Right.
So that's one way in which I've seen it, moving into.
And you're involved with Nowhere, aren't you? Nowhere, which is could you briefly describe what Nowhere is?
They're an artist-run space in Bethnal Green, mm-hmm. an artist-run film lab space, and they have two floors there. And on one floor, they have lots of film production equipment, yeah. Steambecks, optical printers, etc. And on the floor above that, they run seminars, workshops, screenings, and various events. And I've kind of worked with, well, I've known Karen Mirza and Brad Butler and James Hocum, mm-hmm. who run Nowhere for a long time. And recently, in the past two or three years, we've started a magazine together called Sequence,
right?
Which involves, well, it's the focus is artists, film and video, particularly with a view to getting makers writing about work,
right?
And
so there's been two issues of Sequence.
Two issues so far, and the third will be
the third one coming out later
in the
later summer,
this year.
Presumably.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, and they are on the Brad and Karen are on the editorial board mm-hmm. of the magazine, but you are the editor of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's fine. Well, thank you very much to Simon Payne. For coming in and talking about his films. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. And as it is actually Good Friday today, I thought I'd play something sort of with a tenuous link to religion. So here we go.
Now, a whole lot of things been bothering me. Because a lot of people think that things is cool. People ride around in those cars and ride in them airplanes. Pocket full of money and everybody thinks that things is cool. Even old jive president, accident, I mean, would make you think that things is cool. But I'm here to tell all y'all and him too, that we got a cross that we must bear. And the cross gets awful heavy. Now there's the black cross, the green cross, the white cross, the double cross, the crisscross, and the lost cross. And the cross gets awful heavy, different times. But one is supposed to keep on going on and carrying the cross on his shoulder. Because you ain't supposed to let no cross you up. You're supposed to let a cross help you get across. And if you let a cross help you get across, you won't get crossed up, but you'll be on the cross because you done got a cross on the cross. So if you can remember this, you won't get lost on the cross while you're trying to get across. So we just here to let you know about it. I know that you knew already, because y'all the hippest people in the world. Hip, black, and white. But you still know that you got a cross you must deal with. So when it crosses you up, go on and deal with it and leave it alone.